session number 4384, Reel 2 of Mr. J.E. Sutton, August 1914 to November 1915.
Paddy was conveyed in our general service wagon with a corporal in charge of the wagon driver and team. I was in charge of the guard, consisting of one man armed with an unloaded rifle. We got Paddy to the prison in the early afternoon and went to the barracks of the Wiltshire Regiment. Later, I went downtown. The barracks is a quaint historic town on a winding street named the Britics. I went into a store to purchase some stationery. The lady behind the counter invited me to supper. That evening, I met Mr. Willis, their daughter and niece. They were charming people. Mr. Willis ran a real estate and insurance business from an office on the main street. He had to take it easy due to heart trouble. Spent the night at the barracks. Next morning, found the horse had a loose shoe. When this was taken care of, the corporal decided that it was too late to start back to camp. After a second night at the barracks, we left the barracks about 10 a.m. After stopping at a pub for a sandwich and beer, we got back to Westdown North late in the afternoon. This was not a good example of military efficiency. It took four men, two horses, one empty rifle, almost 3 days to get one man to prison about 12 miles away. The weather during November was fairly good, and we were able to hold some mounted drill. Early in December, the rain became almost continuous, sometimes quite heavy. The summer tents with no floorboards were almost as wet inside as outside. The only dry place was the canteen, which was open from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. Beer could be sold to Canadians in uniform, as we were now under British command. The dirt roads had become almost impassable. Drill grounds and horse lines were almost quagmires. The infantry camps had a serious outbreak of spinal meningitis. At the end of December, we were moved into billets in the nearby towns and villages. I started a diary on January the 1st, 1915. The first entry reads, in billets at Wet Hampton, teeny stables, horses and guns, rain all day, no parade in PM, on guard from 6 PM, letter from home. At first, our section occupied a large room over the village store. Later, Corporals Lister and Warrington, Gunner and Medhurst, and Bombardier Sutton were billeted in the Sainsbury farmhouse. We were assigned the care of about 20 ailing horses. We ate army rations for breakfast and lunch, but ate the evening meal with the Sainsbury family. Quite a treat to eat good food properly cooked, and to sleep in a comfortable bed with clean sheets. Brigade headquarters was in the village of Urchfont, and divisional headquarters at Devizes. Later, when the sick horses were cured, I drew the detail of mounted orderly at brigade headquarters. On several occasions, I carried messages to and from the artillery headquarters. Mr. Willis loaned me his bicycle, which he could not ride due to his heart condition. Our subsection sergeant named Kerr permitted the use of this, provided he could ride it occasionally. There was an inspection of horses by the chief veterinary officer of the Southern Command on January the 18th, and on January the 22nd, an inspection of guns by the chief armorer. We left Wedhampton about 8:15 on February the 10th, traveled by road to Putney, and then by train to Avonmouth. There we embarked on a transport, my IDAN, an Austrian ship commandeered by the British. On board were the 9th and 10th batteries, Canadian Field Artillery, also the 15th Battalion of Infantry. Artillery horses, guns, and wagons were below. Infantry transport horses were tethered on deck. We left Avonmouth early on February the 12th. Next day, we ran into a heavy gale in the Bay of Biscay. Horses on deck were swept overboard, and two horses of the 10th Battery were killed. One infantryman was swept overboard and drowned. The hatches were open, and some waves poured over onto the lower deck, where an officer's groom and myself were perched on some bales of hay. At first, I was afraid that the ship might sink, and later, I was hoping that it would. The horses we were looking after came through safely without attention from us. The gale abated early on February the 14th. Our British destroyers were replaced by French gunboats. We lay off St. Nazaire all night and landed early on February the 15th. Until noon, I did get out to a cafe for some coffee and cakes. Our long cavalry overcoats were replaced with a shorter type known as the British Warm. These reached to about 6 inches above the knee, much more serviceable. We had trained and left St. Nazaire about 11 p.m. With an officer's groom named McKee, I rode in a boxcar with 8 officer's mounts, 4 on each side facing the center of the car. Saddles and bridles, also a bale of hay, occupied the center, which was our living space. Horses had been watered and fed before in training. We had been given 3 days' rations of bully beef, bread, jam, and cheese. Horses were quiet throughout the night. Stopped at a station where we watered and fed the horses. Got a drink of hot tea and attended to the calls of nature. In the afternoon, we fed half the bale of hay to keep the horses quiet. The oil lamp went out about midnight. We stopped later at some unknown town where we got a candle and bought 2 bottles of red wine. The wine tasted like vinegar at first, but improved as we got to the bottom of the bottle. We needed the empty bottle to serve as a candle holder. The horses began to get restless, so we fed them the rest of the hay, blew out the candle, and settled down to get some rest. Later, I heard a horse's hoof strike our candle holder. They were pawing and had pulled a couple of saddles under their hooves. These were recovered and spent the rest of the night sitting in the open door of the car, where we finished the second bottle of wine. Next morning, we had a hay and oat stop for the horses and a tea and comfort stop for the men at Abbeville. Continued on to Hasbrook, where we detrained. Moved on to the village of Caser, where we arrived about 6 p.m. Then went into the village of Far Rouge. Remained here until March the 1st, while the rest of the Canadian division was assembled. We were issued a new range finder for the direction of a troop design. The director had a compass provided for taking bearings as well as for measuring angles. Also got some instruction in map reading. Finally, we were issued gun and rifle ammunition. Shotgun shells were the only type available at this time for field guns. These were fitted with fire percussion fuses. In fact, this fuse setting using dummy shells. Time fuses were used to have shells burst in the air and spread about 200 lead pellets over an area of about 200 square feet. Meanwhile, our officers visited nearby British forces. On Sunday, February the 21st, we went to church parade for the 48th Highlanders from Toronto. Finally, on March the 2nd, we moved up and went into action on the outskirts of the village of Salis-de-Lalise. Guns unlimited and fire and battery wagons set in place. Apple trees provided concealment. There was no other protection. Lines of fire were laid out and ranges scaled from detailed geodetic maps. Horse lines were set up about 2 miles in the rear. We were billeted in farm buildings near the guns. Skeleton crews were kept on duty at the guns at all times. The village of Salis-de-Lalise was fully occupied and people seemed to be going about their normal tasks. It was a queer kind of war. In the first 2 weeks, just 4 German shells fell into a field nearby. Cameras were forbidden, so I had to give up my best pocket Kodak. It was sent to my sister in England, but did not arrive. Due to shortage of ammunition, we were limited to firing 6 rounds per battery per day. These could have been fired by one gun in less than 1 minute. The shrapnel we were firing was ineffective against troops in trenches, provided that they kept their heads down. We would save up until we could fire 24 rounds to establish lines and ranges to key targets. At times, we had to stop the farmer from plowing in front of our guns so that we could fire. An observing station was set up in an abandoned house near the trenches. This was manned around the clock by an officer and 2 signalers. Communication was by telephone. A line was strung about 2 miles and maintained by 2 men, McDonald and Sutton. They operated as such for about 18 months or some more. On March the 9th, the British attacked Mont Chapelle using British and Indian troops. This was on our immediate right. We fired 100 rounds of high explosive shells per gun. Our company stood by to exploit any possible gains. The whole thing turned out to be an expensive operation. Heavy losses to gain a short section of trench. Some 1,200 prisoners were taken. Souvenir German helmets and belts were traded around freely for a short time. On March the 28th, the 1st Canadian Division moved to the right and with the British Division were to make another attack. We moved into a position which had been occupied by a British battery. There was considerable damage by German shellfire. Only one gun with its ammunition wagons was to be in the field at the same time. When another gun moved in before the previous teams were clear, Major McDougall blew up and called the offenders 3 cornered buggers of hell. We established an observing station in the attic of a Sheldon farmhouse. I had run a telephone line and was watching the burst of our shells when the Germans opened fire on several buildings in our vicinity. A shell passed through the roof a few feet above and to my right. Fortunately, it did not explode, but a tile from the roof hit me in the ankle. At first, I thought I had lost my left foot, but used it in getting out of there in a hurry, together with Mr. McDonnell and 2 signalers. We took shelter on the safe side of the house. When things quieted down, we went back and completed our spotting. Fortunately, the second phase of the Neuve Chapelle operation was called off. We fired 100 rounds or more per day of high explosives and got some retaliation, but only minor casualties. for parts unknown. On the first day of our trek, I drew the uncertain privilege of fetching my horse to the officer's flag. A three-wheeled wooden cart loaded with officers' kit, and accompanied by two officer servants on foot, who were at the tail end of the battery column. Just before noon, all the spokes fell out of one wheel. We pulled the truck clear of the road and went to a nearby farmhouse where Mr. McDonnell negotiated hiring another cart. By the time we got moving again, all the several vehicles were out of sight. We finally caught up with the battery in billets at Hardefort. The following day, Mr. McDonnell took me as his horse holder, riding his second horse, while another mounted man pulled the empty cart, which was returned to its owner, who refused any payment for its use. On our way back, we saw a French infantry battalion drawn up for inspection. Uniforms of blue coats lined with white, buttoned back to show a white triangle above the red pantaloons. With clippers on their heads, they looked exactly like troops of the 1870 war. We stayed at Hardefort until April 17th. The fugitivity of one French division passed through. The equipment and horses were in but very bad condition. Guns were old style. The new 75mm guns were replacing these. The horses remained living and many had saddle sores. For 2 days I was laid up with a swollen ankle, slight damage from the weak pile. Passed 2 days in the saddle. The 3rd Brigade Infantry and Artillery were inspected by General Smith-Dorrien, the British commander of the Ypres Salient. Left Hardefort the morning of April 17th, trapped in a field outside the city of Poplin. It rained heavily during the night, but what shelter we could from the hedges bundled up in our waterproof sheets. Next morning made our way to Ypres. Wipers to the British soldier. The city had been heavily shelled, especially the historic center. The Cloth Hall had been gutted by shells and fire. The cathedral was practically destroyed and was still smoldering. A battalion of British infantry passed us on their way to a rest area. They were down to less than half strength. The outskirts of the city were inhabited, as was villages and farms, as far as St. Jean, about 10 miles north. We went into action under some willow trees along a stream outside the village of St. Julian. The Ypres salient had been heavily contested since the beginning of trench warfare. Shell fire was heavy from both sides. On April the 19th, we laid a telephone line to the observing station and one to brigade headquarters. Lines and ranges to targets to the right and left of the town of Paul-Capel inside the German lines were determined by firing on April the 20th. Our telephone line was cut early on April the 22nd. We repaired this near the cemetery just north of St. Julian. I went to the observing station as one of the signalers, Corporal Lister, was taken seriously ill. So I stayed with the other man and the observing officer, Lieutenant Green. Major McDougall came in from the front line trenches and sent the observing officer and the signaler back to the guns. I stayed on with the major. In mid-afternoon, we saw yellow fumes coming from the German front line trench opposite the trenches held by our left battalion, the 48th Highlanders. The German artillery opened fire along our front and that of a French Algerian division on our left. This gas attack was the start of the Second Battle of Ypres. I got through to the guns with orders to open fire on all targets right and left of the Paul-Capel Road. then both telephone lines were cut. A change in the wind took the gas to the left of our line and further across the front of the Algerian division. The gas was followed by German infantry wearing gas masks. When hit by the chlorine gas, the whole Algerian line collapsed. Infantry threw away their rifles and ran. The artillery abandoned their guns. German infantry poured through the gap and tried to penetrate behind our infantry line. The Canadian division had one brigade in reserve. Each of the other brigades in the line had a battalion in reserve. The 3rd Brigade Reserve Battalion, the 16th Highlanders, came in within the hour. By 6 p.m., all reserve units were engaged, and the gap between our left flank and the Belgian division to the north was partially closed. From our position in the roof of a damaged farmhouse, we had a good view of our front and were above any gas. Major McDougall told me he had heard more shellfire within 1 hour than in the whole Boer War. When we left, we had to use a ditch because a German machine gun was covering the rear of the building. Our guns had swung around considerably to the left. Gunner Bill Hagier had been wounded, and I took his place as number 2 gunner on number 4 gun. Number 3 gun was firing almost directly into my left ear. Later, when we stopped firing, I went with McDonald to see if the road was clear so that we could move our guns to the rear. German infantry were about at the edge of the town. The cemetery at the crossroads, which in the morning was filled with ornate memorials and artificial flowers under glass, was completely wrecked. On the main street, we saw 6 Highlanders moving a grand piano from a house. When we asked them where they were taking it, they said they did not know, and then quit the job. Our casualties were 6 men wounded, 4 of the guns, and 2 drivers bringing up ammunition. We moved back after dark to a position on the outskirts of St. Jean. McDonald and Sutton pushed our rear cart, which held over 2 miles of telephone wire, our telephones, belt reels, pliers, etc. Our kit bags and coats were lost in the move. The next morning, a mixed force of British infantry formed up behind us and the 12th Battery, which had moved in on our left. The infantry attacked through our guns, which shelled the high ground to the west. Some Germans retaliated, and we lost 8 men killed and 4 wounded. The infantry attack was successful. They linked up with the Belgians, closing the gap left by the Algerians. Our losses to date were more than 10% of our strength. I helped the wounded Northumberland Fusilier to the dressing station. He gave me his overcoat. Later in the day, we pulled back across the main road and went into action behind a wood. After being fired at by enemy guns, which we could see to our rear, we went back to the other side of the wood. In the wood was a chateau, deserted but undamaged. The occupants must have been heavy champagne drinkers, as there were several walls built of empty champagne bottles. A direct hit by an enemy shell threw glass fragments a considerable distance. We were hopelessly outgunned, to count only 8 field guns and 2 4.7-inch guns in our vicinity. The wood was being shelled by over 24 guns, mostly heavies. Behind our guns was a playhouse for the owner and his male guests. Servants' quarters below were the paneled room above, reached by an outside stairway. There was some beautiful cut glass, but no liquor. Also a large oil painting of drinking and wenching scenes. For about a week, McDonald and Sutton slept in the upper room. The building had a thatched roof, which was hit by an incendiary shell. We got out with our belongings in a hurry. Next day, Major McDougal said to me, Sutton, I have cursed and damned every man in the battery, individually and collectively. And when I was foolish enough to go into a burning building to get a picture, a man from the 9th Battery came along to see that I got out safely. I did not tell the Major that MacDonald had told me that he went back to get the picture, but that the old man beat him to it. The 9th and 12th Batteries remained in action outside St. Jean for about 2 weeks after the rest of the Canadian Division moved out. Some additional field guns moved in, but we were still outgunned. The enemy were using 17-inch howitzers to shell Ypres. The shells sounded almost like freight trains as they passed over. Looking back into the city, you could see several houses disintegrate when a shell exploded. The Lahore Division from India came into the battle. The infantry were mainly Gurkhas with British officers. The men carried their long, curved knives. They preferred to use these at close quarters rather than the bayonets. Herds of goats were used to supply them with milk, and special flowers provided for them to make their own chapatis. They wore broad-brimmed khaki hats with black bands. I picked one of these up and was wearing it to replace my worn-out cap. One of their officers asked me if I was tired of living. I told him that I was not. He advised that I get rid of the Gurkha hat. If its original owner was living, he would have lost caste. If dead, he would remain in purgatory until one of his comrades stuck a knife into the infidel wearing the hat. I immediately threw away the hat. A Gurkha never drew his knife without drawing blood, even if he had to cut his own finger. They could not stand the cold, damp climate and were shortly sent to Egypt. The Lahore Division was relieved by a British division, which included the 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Rifles. We had a visit by Paddy Carroll, the man we had left in the Devizes military prison. He had volunteered and been accepted by his old regiment. He was warmly greeted by all members of the 9th Battery, including Major McDougal. Shortly after, I was on duty as a signaller in a front-line trench held by the Royal Irish Rifles. The Germans appeared to be getting ready to attack. Shelling was heavy on the trenches and forward areas. Our telephone line was cut, so I started back to the guns with a message. Was stopped by a staff officer at a reserve trench. He wanted to know who I was and to where I was running. I satisfied him and had just started out when a salvo of 77-millimeter shells fell about 100 yards ahead. I mentally thanked the gentleman for delaying me. Returning to the guns, I repaired the telephone line. Things had quieted down, but shelling was still fairly heavy. I was talking to a private in the Royal Irish Rifles when a shell burst behind him. A splinter hit him in the back. Our officer told him he would soon be back in Ireland. He replied, I am finished, sir. He lasted only a few minutes. The 9th Battery moved back that night to a position across the Yser Canal, just west of Ypres. The guns were in a ditch with the muzzles poked through the hedge. We were not to fire except in case of an emergency. On my way back to the guns, I saw two piles of rifles which had been thrown away by the Algerians the day of the gas attack. After 2 days in the front line, I went back to the horse lines to get some rest. They had moved to a farm outside into the south of Ypres. Late in the afternoon, I lined up for an issue of rum for the first time. After dark, I returned to the guns with the ration wagon. Sergeant Masters was acting as Sergeant Major. He started to issue rum from a fresh 2-gallon jar. Major McDougal gave him a partially used jar to be used first. Tommy Boyd managed to get the new jar and poured some into a mess tin. Tommy and I had earlier leveled out of the section at the bottom of the ditch with a dirt-covered board to protect our heads, slept in our clothes on waterproof sheets with our blankets for covers. Woke in the early morning to find almost a half an inch of water in our hole. Took a swig of the rum and sat around waiting for breakfast. Behind our guns were several craters from the 17-inch shells. One of these in a paved road was over 30 feet in diameter by about 20 feet deep. We moved back to billets outside the dune, May the 24th. We're ordered back into action the next day. Our major protested as we had been in action for over 5 weeks and our guns were leaking oil from the recoil systems. We were given 1 week to rest and repair. The second battle of Ypres lasted from April the 22nd to May the 26th. The British used 2 regular, 1 territorial, 1 Indian, and 1 Canadian division. Total casualties for the 5 divisions exceeded 40,000, with 8,000 killed.